parentheses, Srimadesi, Bhaktivedanta Sanaprabhupada Ki Jai. Iskand Bhandar Acharya, Srimadesi, Ki Jai. Jai Vishnu God, Paramahansa, Padi Vrajaka, Acharya, Stotara, Satsi, Srimadhi, Sadan, Saraswati, Thakur, Ki Jai. Ananta Koti, Vaishnava, Rinda, Ki Jai. Nama Acharya, Sita Haridas, Thakur, Ki Jai. Prem Sikahal, Sri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu, Nityananda, Siddhaita, Gadadhar, Sivasadi, Gaur, Bhakti, Rinda, Ki Jai. Sisi Radha, Krishna, Gogobinata, Shama, Kunda, Radha, Kunda, Giri, Govardhan, Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham, Ki Jai. Mayapur Dham, Ki Jai. Jagannath Swami, Ki Jai. Ganga Mayi Ki Jai, Yamuna Mayi Ki Jai, Tulsi Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Devi Ki Jai, Sarvita Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, glories the assembled devotees, Gaur Premanandi Ki Jai.
speaker for today is Holiness Vidyananda Das Goswami. He's been a practitioner of Bhakti Yoga, Krishna Consciousness, for the last 42 years. And
starting from the age of minus three.
Yes. He was born very, very young, much younger than most people. And he's a disciple of His Divine Grace, E.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, whose disappearance anniversary is today. He passed away in 1977. And he was commended for his transcendental intelligence, even at an early age in the movement. Let's not talk about age anymore. And because he could read and speak Sanskrit just on his own by reading Srila Prabhupada's books. So he was sent to the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust branch in Boston, where the books were produced, translated by Srila Prabhupada. And then after a very fruitful and long career as a spiritual manager, if that's not an oxymoron, he fortunately was able to relinquish that flavorful position for a more secluded. Although he opened many centers in South America and mostly southeast of the United States, the countries that Krishna consciousness was not known previously. Then one of Prabhupada's instructions to him when he was a young bhakta, a young devotee, was to finish school because he had only had one semester to go. He was going to University of California in Berkeley. And due to youth, again, age is a factor, he could not, he was so enthusiastic about Krishna consciousness and not so enthusiastic about school, I assume, and particularly in Berkeley in 1969, you can imagine why.
Don't know much about history.
Yeah. So eventually, 30 years later, approximately, he decided to finish school. So he went to UCLA.
20 years later, actually.
20 years. So he was able to take a few courses to his choice, and since most of the subjects that he didn't complete by 1969 did not exist any longer. and then he went in record time. He went to Harvard Divinity School.
Actually, this is Harvard Graduate School.
Oh, Harvard Graduate School. Oh, yeah.
Arts and Sciences. It's
different. Yeah. So he got his PhD at Harvard. From a moment, he went back to UCLA, where he finished his undergrad school, until his PhD, about just slightly over 2 years that transpired, which is...
Three and a half.
Well, that's slightly over 2 years. And now he's been for a while. He's been concentrating on a book. He also translated some of after Prabhupada translated his magnum opus, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the cream of the crop of the Vedic literature. He went to as far as the 10th canto, the third volume of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. So there were many volumes, particularly of Krishna Lila, in the 10th canto and then the 11th and 12th canto, him together with the late Gopi Bharanadana Das Prabhu, translated from Sanskrit to English, and published many other books and lecture all over the world, literally in several languages, in which he's actually fluent in 5-6 languages. And now he's in Santa Barbara. He's working on a novel, and hopefully will come out within our lifetime and his. So here, please give him a warm reception, unlike mine. Vidyananda Das Goswami.
I would like to, in that same warm manner, introduce a very good friend of mine, visiting us from Brazil, this is Don Guthrie's fault. I mean, I'm going to do my best to embarrass him. It's not difficult by explaining all the wonderful things he's done. Dhanvantri Swami joined the Hare Krishna movement. He's one of the first devotees in Brazil. And he was as a young man, he had a brilliant career. He was a dentist. He went to the best dental school in Brazil. And as a young guy, he opened his clinic, and he had everything he needed in Brazil to be very successful, very affluent person. And it was all ruined by this spiritual thing he got into. Anyway, he was at heart, he was really a devotee of Krishna, and he's really been, I was in charge of Brazil for a very long time, and was really the first leader there to develop things here and there. And Dhanvantri Swami, without question, has been one of the most important leaders there for many, many, many years. He created a school, a children's school, at a farm we had between Rio and Sao Paulo, which was the best school in Latin America, the best children's school, I mean, best spiritual children's school in Latin America. Now, he teaches adults, and he's created the first Krishna conscious seminary, a very serious seminary in northeast Brazil, a beautiful campus that he himself created, and I mean, not in the sense like God, but in the sense of taking some land and building things there. And so he's created this very beautiful campus in Brazil, and he actually has many hundreds of disciples and followers around the world, mostly in Brazil, but everywhere. And he's, I would say, unlike me, he's like the real thing. He's really like he's really a great devotee, and he's been visiting me for about 3 weeks. He's on his way to India, where he's going to be sampling water at different locations. Just kidding. He's going to, drink water in India. He's going to India, and he's going to be supervising a course in Portuguese, which is, of course, his native language, in Mayapur. So he was initiated by Srila Prabhupada in what year? 1977, just before Prabhupada passed away. Received first initiation from Prabhupada. And so he really is a wonderful devotee, and we're very fortunate he's here. Would you like to say a few words before I speak? Perhaps we can He's actually very humble. Kind of takes after me, and so that's a joke for those of you who know me. So anyway, if you get a chance before you go, he really is a wonderful devotee. Dhanvantri Swami. So thank you all very much for coming. I'm really very happy to be here, really. And today is what we call the disappearance day of Srila Prabhupada. So many of you, of course, know what that means, but I thought I would explain, basically, what this is all about, why we're doing this. Because the nature of spiritual knowledge is that it bears repetition. And as we increase our own consciousness, as we become more conscious and more pure in our own practice, we actually can appreciate, relish the knowledge more and more. So, first, it's called, the term disappearance day is a translation of a term which is widely used in India. The Sanskrit term is Tirobhav. Tirobhav Mahotsav Titi, the festival of someone's, something like in English we say passing. I mean, you could say someone died on a certain day, which kind of means they're just, that's the end. But then we also say someone passed away. If you take that word literally, to pass is not to stop existing. It just means you were here and then you went there. And even terms like passing away, if we do a little, quick little linguistic anthropology here, I mean, even terms like passing away are based on what used to be something like a
cultural consensus that death is not the end of the soul. And that's where those terms come from. So, now, at the time of death, something really does end, obviously, and it's not merely a physical apparatus, which is the body, that previously housed a soul. This is a great place to sneeze, because there's so many spiritual people here to give blessings. So if you need to sneeze, here's the place to do it. Anyway, in Sanskrit, there is a term, ahankara, which we usually translate false ego. The word aham in Sanskrit means I. It's the first person, singular, personal pronoun, I. And, well, without going into linguistics, because Sarvatma may get his hook out, but there's a tendency for a Sanskrit H to become European G. As, for example, a Sanskrit word vahana, vehicle, becomes a German word wagen, as in Volkswagen. Or maha, which in Sanskrit means great, becomes magna in Latin. So similarly, aham, Sanskrit aham, you just change the H to a G, you get the Greek ego. And so ahankara literally means egoism, sort of like that, or egotism. I never really looked up why you put a T in there sometimes, or maybe it's just optional. But anyway, egoism or egotism. And so the idea is that we are eternal souls, and at the present time, we are doing business within a material body. And so whatever kind of body you have, you know, whatever gender, race, age, ethnicity, size, or species for that matter, that's what it is. It's just, you know, whatever model you have, like you have a late model American body or something. So I guess I'm the late model. But anyway, so we have this body, and there are some people who take, for example, here's an example Prabhupada often gave a car and a driver. Now, some people identify with their cars, like you are what you drive. And there have been many love songs written to cars. I mean, this was, I guess it's not so much in the 60s, right? The Beach Boys and all kinds of Jan and Dean. I mean, they were... So, I mean, obviously, let's say someone buys a really sexy car or something, and it's a really great car, and somehow as they drive off the lot, it's like, I am transformed. I am not the same person I was before I got behind the wheel of this car. And of course, we know that's really not true. It's really just you. But if you think about it, that type of false identification that somehow the status of this car or the sleek lines or expensive options, you know, something about it, somehow it reflects on me, like I've become a new and better, greater person because I'm driving this machine. Now, I mean, really that's not true. I think, I mean, won't belabor that point. I think this audience is intelligent enough to know the sense in which it's really still you. Or, for example, if we dress, I mean, some people, they get all excited when they, say, get some new clothes. And somehow, I am a greater person than I was. I'm more attractive than I was. I'm just more important than I was, or something like that. So if you think about the ways in which we take something which is obviously not us, even from the material point of view, even if you say, for example, okay, let's imagine that we are the body. Let's imagine the body is really me. So I really am male or female or this or that age or size or whatever. Still, the clothes technically are not you. I mean, it's something extrinsic to you. And the car is not really you. And yet, psychologically, it somehow becomes melded into or it somehow becomes integrated within my identity. So I now, my self-understanding is me, the owner of this car, or me, the person who's like dressed to kill, or something like that. And somehow it all kind of fuses into this identity. And technically it's a false ego in the sense it's not really me, it's just stuff. And so that's exactly what we do with the body. We really are eternal souls, which is a great thing to be, because I mean, if you have a chance, click on the I am a soul button, because the idea is, as Krishna explains in the Gita, souls as souls, we have always existed, and we always will exist. There's no birth or death. There's no old age or disease for the soul, and every soul is actually shockingly beautiful. So, even though we are souls, we take the body to be ourself. And Krishna analogizes the body in the Gita to a set of clothes. He says, vasamsi jirnani jatha vihaya, just as one gives up worn out clothes. Navani granati naroparani, and a person takes new clothes, puts on new clothes. Tata shadidani vihaya jirnani, so a person gives up worn out bodies and then takes new bodies. So just as there is a false ego, false identification with the clothes, our thinking in the material sense, I'm male, female, this age, that size, race, ethnicity, nationality, whatever, is a false ego. And yet, functionally in the world, we really run with it, so to speak. You know, so, for example, we've all got our documents, like driver's license or birth certificate or passport or even more existentially significant, our credit cards. And so we've got all this stuff with our name on it, that the name that was given to the body. By the way, this is one area of philosophy that we share with many traditional forms of Buddhism. The idea that this world is nama-rupa, it's a bunch of, say, rupa, all these material forms that emerge and then demerge. You know what I mean? They emerge and they dissolve, all these material forms, and then we put names on things, like a bunch of matter, just a bunch of material energy, you know, formed into a body, and it was you. It was like a brand new bouncing baby girl or boy. Babies don't really bounce in the hospital, do they?
Yeah,
they
drop them.
So a bunch of matter is formed into a body, and then a name is put on it. Or, for example, we put the name chair on this. And I mean, functionally, it is a chair. It functions as a chair. It's like a bunch of material energy doing business as a chair, operating as a chair. And so in the same way, we have our identity. Let's say, like, I'm a citizen of this country, and I, you know, belong to this or that, or I belong to this family, or that community. And so, even though I'm a soul, and I'm not the body, still, in my theatrical performance as this body, because we're all performing, we're all, like, out there performing as if we were the body, and so we create a life for ourselves. It's like people do that now on computers, right? Like, you know, the secret life of Joe the computer addict, and, you know, where he creates a new identity, and unbeknownst to his wife, is, you know, has a cyber wife somewhere, and all kinds of little cyber children, and which is, you know, activities like this obviously are a sign of very strong mental health. And so, but what we do is we have this life as the body. And so at the time of death, that, you could say, persona, that role, that life comes to an end. So now, if I've lived my life as if I were the body, in other words, like spiritual things bore me, is this a spiritual program? Okay, no thanks. It's like if I lived my life as if I were the body, and really believed it, really get into it, and I'm all about my body. And so then at the time of death, everything that I invested in, everything that in my own mind gave meaning to life, really is over. Because it's like, you know, game over, and the game's really over. However, if we live our lives spiritually, so that I'm all about my real self, who I really am, the real person that's eternal, and that's just operating this body as a virtual reality machine. Like at the present time, yes, I'm seeing through these eyes, I'm hearing through these ears, I'm acting through this body, but it's me acting through this body. And so if I am focused on my real spiritual identity, then the time of death, it's really like no big deal. not that we should all go and, you know, this is not to encourage suicide or anything. Because, you know, part of being a loving servant of God is that you just kind of go with the program as it's coming from more intelligent people than ourselves. And so, but still, now in the case of Prabhupada, you have something sort of a third category. You could say there are people who are materialistic, people who try to focus on spiritual things, and then there are people who really are there. They really are completely Krishna conscious. They're completely in touch with their own spiritual identity. In that sense, people on Prabhupada's level can be legitimately called avatars. An avatar is not simply someone who foils a capitalistic attempt to rape a foreign planet. But the word ava in Sanskrit means downward. It's actually not a word, it's a prefix. So the prefix ava means downward, and tara means crossing. And so avatara literally means the descender, the one who crosses down. And so the avatar, the word avatar, is applied to someone who exists in a higher level, a higher realm, dimension, etc., and then crosses down into this world to try to help us. So that's literally what the word avatar means. It's interesting because from the same root that gives us the word tara, crossing, there's another common Sanskrit word, tirtha. Tara Tirtha, which in India is the common word for a holy place or a pilgrimage place, some place that's spiritually worth going to on pilgrimage. And the reason is because generally the Tirthas, the holy place that people go to on pilgrimage, are places where avatars, where great souls, either God or, you know, someone deputized by the Lord, you know, someone comes down and helps us down here. And so wherever the avatars, the great souls, like Krishna himself, wherever they came, those places become tirtha, because they cross down there. But when an avatar crosses down, it's like the channel remains open. That's the great thing. That when an avatar comes down, the path of their descent remains open until you can cross back up. And that's why the same word is used, tara, avatara, and tirtha. So they kind of, you know, bulldoze a highway through the dense darkness of the material world, and then you can go back up. So Prabhupada, I think on reasonable grounds was a pure soul. It's not just faith, like he looked at me and zapped me and I had some magical experience. I mean, that's nice, but how should I put it? One of the reasons that some people struggle with spiritual claims or religious claims is that there's a lot of them out there, and there's sort of a perception among skeptics that they seem to be mutually exclusive, or they contradict each other, and you can't really prove anything. And so, I mean, there is a lot of irrational skepticism, and even what I would call insincere skepticism. And I call it irrational and insincere because the people denying spiritual claims have absolutely no intention or desire to explore them or to see if they can be verified. And so to deny something which you are not willing to explore, to me, is an insincere denial, as well as an irrational one. So, that's skepticism. Also, just to make one other little point here, there is a common misconception that the world is full of, like, thousands, if not millions, of competing, contradictory religious spiritual claims. They can't all be true, so that means, you know, they must all be wrong, blah, blah, blah. And that really, I mean, that kind of skepticism usually comes from people who have not actually studied world religions and sort of don't know what they're talking about. Because there really are just a few basic claims. I mean, the names may change. Like, you may call the god of the sun this, and someone else calls the god of the sun that. But all around the world, you see that pre-industrial civilizations talked about a god of the sun. So, if you actually study seriously world religions, there's not an infinite variety, and they don't really contradict each other. they don't contradict each other at the level of philosophy, at the level of theology and structuralism, but at the level of dogma. For example, let's say I claim that so-and-so is the Son of God, and the only Son of God, he was born in this place, and you have to be saved by this person. Now, theologically or philosophically, the claim is very simple. You're claiming that someone, a person, may appear in this world representing God, and that person may be empowered with the ability to free people from their conditioning, their, let's say, from the karmic reactions of previous imprudent behavior, and so on, and elevate those people to spiritual freedom. That is the theological claim. Now, if I start putting very specific requirements on, like it has to be, it's only the person with this name, like Jesus or Muhammad, the prophet, or you could even say Krishna. I mean, when I get so specific that anyone that doesn't accept someone with this name who appeared in this place at that time is, you're finished. You're basically your metaphysical toast. Because you didn't. So there's a huge difference between dogmatic claims, which are historically specific. You've got to accept this person at this time in this place, and a general philosophical or theological claim that you can see what I'm saying. Because the philosophical category, if I say, for example, that we're all children of God, and the good kids sometimes are given the responsibility to come to Earth and help out the kids that are kind of in a mess. So that's a general claim. So we can recognize all around the world in many different religions people who did that. But if I say, no, it's only Jesus, it's only Muhammad, it's only this person, it's only Prabhupada or something like that, that's a dogmatic claim. It's not philosophical. There's no philosophical category. There's no philosophical category like Son of God, Prophet, Avatar. It's just it's a dogma. So the dogmas are all against each other. But if you look at world religions, when you get to the level of philosophy and theology, there's only, basically, people are saying kind of the same thing, maybe with a few varieties. And then, which we talk about, like, roughly animism, polytheism, or pantheism, impersonalism, personalism, and that's about kind of, that's it. And then you get all kinds of varieties of it. So, the reason I'm mentioning this is because I think one of the main reasons the world is so ridiculously tilted toward materialism, the reason the world is, as they say, going to hell in a handbasket, is that, we have all this spiritual science. Like if you want to, let's say, manufacture and market a new and better chewing gum, then you can hire literally hundreds and thousands of Harvard MBAs and, people from all the best schools, and they will develop computer programs, and you have this like massive science to figure out how to develop a better chewing gum. I mean, so everything in the material world, everything is like being done so scientifically, and yet on the spiritual realm, it's just like in the spiritual realm, in a sense, spirituality has been reduced to psychology. Like if it makes you feel good. I mean, obviously, if you're doing something spiritual, it should make you feel good, shouldn't make you, miserable. But there needs to be a spiritual science. Because if on the one hand, you have material science, and the other hand, you have, whatever makes you feel good is true for you. Whatever that means. Like, what is it? Like, I can understand saying that, let's say, when I was a kid, I really liked orange sherbet ice cream. Maybe it's just orange sherbet. But I really liked it. And so it was true for me. I mean, the fact that orange sherbet tasted good to me was true for me. If someone else didn't like it, well, it's not true for you that orange sherbet tastes good. But then again, maybe you have a different physiology if you're actually not tasting what I am. So it's one thing, which is just personal preference. But if you say, well, this is my God, or if I don't believe in God, then for me there's no God. If I do, there is a God for me. Or if I think this, or if I think that. And so it's like the customer is always right. And in this age of consumerism, spirituality is just another consumer product. And so there is no real truth. There is no truth with a capital T. There is nothing. It's just whatever you like, that's your truth, and there is no objective truth outside of you, greater than you, that has to be discovered. And so it's kind of like this extremism where we've gone from, Lynn, you know, we were talking about this, psychology, that there's a, well, it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder means, tell me if I get this right, that someone goes through a traumatic event. Typical examples are people that went through combat or children that witnessed, let's say, some violence. And so you go through a traumatic event, and then after it's over, it's post-traumatic because the traumatic event is over, but because it sort of shocked your nervous system. Therefore, it creates this stress which goes on. So after the trauma, you're still suffering from the stress disorder. And so, interestingly, two of the main symptoms of this disorder are hypervigilance. In other words, if something really shocked your nervous system, like you can't bear to have that happen again, and therefore you become hypervigilant. I mean, sort of like the, you know, the cartoon example. Let's say a combat veteran hears a car backfire and dives for cover. So, I mean, you hear, let's say if you haven't been in combat and you hear a car backfire, you don't dive for cover. So, it's, and because of this hypervigilance, there's a tendency to withdraw just because you just, like, you can't risk it. It's too risky. You can't go through another traumatic event like that. And so, the simple point that I want to make, did I get that right? Basically, the basic point I wanted to make is, that if you look at the religious history of the Western world and other places, but we'll talk about the West, I think it's absolutely clear it is a traumatic history. I mean, you know, it can, if you walk out of your cottage one day and you see one of your neighbors being burned alive because they have the wrong religion, I mean, you know, it could ruin your whole day. So if you think of the religious history of people brutally killing each other, not even like, you know, trying to do it in the most painless way possible, but really brutally killing, torturing each other, and despising each other, and cursing each other over religion, the history is deeply traumatic. And so I think it's clear that when you have huge numbers of people suffering from a post-traumatic stress disorder, it actually becomes a sociological fact as much as a psychological fact. In other words, it's not just that this individual psychologically is suffering this disorder, but a civilization can suffer from it. And so what we're seeing now among the sort of wannabe intellectuals of our age is a type of irrational skepticism. You see it in the academy, you know, the universities, where they have this sort of like mindless, irrational, pseudo-intellectual skepticism. So no one wants to be accused of having blind faith, but blind doubt, no problem. In an academic environment, I mean, to believe something that's not true or not to believe something that is true, it's not clear that one is better or worse than the other. So in an academic environment, if you say, I don't believe in all that stuff, it's like, that's respectable. You don't have to give, like, well, give, you don't have to give cogent reasons, like, why don't you believe in the solar God? It's just the mere fact that you're skeptical is sort of intellectually respectable. But if you believe in spiritual things, really? That's interesting. It's not as intellectually respectable to go, let's say, like, tell everybody, you know, that I found God or something. And so, in an act, so, Prabhupada, one, I mean, getting back to Prabhupada, this is Disappearance Day, I think I see as his, and I want to end because I don't want to go on too long. Prabhupada, I see Prabhupada historically, his great contribution that as a pure soul, as someone who really does love Krishna. I mean, I personally, and again, I don't want to reduce it just down to my personal experiences, although I did, to the best of my understanding, did experience his purity in being with him. I mean, I was with Prabhupada many times, and I really never saw him do or think about anything. Wait, the about only is with the think. Do anything or think about anything, or which was not directly related to selfless service to Krishna. You know, sometimes he would relax, sometimes he was intense, but there was no downtime. It's not like, okay, that's enough spirituality for today, let's like go play tennis or something. I mean, he was just always... He was just always completely focused on Krishna. Never acted selfishly, never acted out of pride. He was the real thing. He just, his character, his behavior, the way he treated other people, the way he lived his life. He was really a pure lover of God. And he gave us this spiritual science. He gave us this spiritual science. By which we can, by chanting, which we just did, by practicing it, if you do it with an open heart, I mean, you can't do it, it's like, let's say you go on a date, and this will make, especially resonate with our brahmacharis and sannyasis, but I mean, let's, that's a joke. But let's say you go on a date, and the other person says, I'm really sure I'm not going to like you, but go ahead, you know, make me fall in love with you. You've got like 3 hours. It's like, oh my God, you are the person I'm looking for. Not. So, and obviously that's not the beginning to a great relationship. And so in the same way, if someone really has an open heart, and tries to understand Krishna, Krishna's really there. I mean, God is there. It's not that Krishna's there, but Allah isn't there. I mean, when we say Krishna, we mean God. This is just a very advanced understanding of God. So, if you really put your heart into it, you will come to see that Prabhupada has presented a spiritual science. Getting back to this PTSD little rap song that I did, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, because of the murderous, monstrous violence that took place among competing religions in world history, especially in Europe and the Middle East. They didn't have that many religious wars in India. The result is that among, let's say, educated people, it's almost like not polite. It's not even, it's hardly really polite or respectable to, like, claim that this is better than that. It's like everyone has their own path, and because it's sort of the assumption is that as soon as you say this is better, you're taking it straight back to the Middle Ages, and okay, Mr. Inquisitor, tell me about your faith. So there's this fear, but if you look at India, where for the most part people didn't kill each other over religion, they, you know, actually even in ancient Europe they didn't. Pagan Europe. I mean, let's fellowship around applause for the pagans. Anyway, if you look at pagan Europe before it was saved, there was actually religious freedom. But, I mean, if you look at let's say Greco-Roman civilization, especially under the Roman Empire, it was really something like Mediterranean Hinduism. If you look at ancient Greek religion, Roman religion, it was very much like Mediterranean Hinduism. And there really was freedom of religion to a great extent, which was destroyed by when Europe was saved. So what I mean to say is, in cultures, in civilizations where there is religious freedom, and for a long time there's been religious freedom, and so therefore it's like safe and okay and respectable to debate the points. Because it's understood that there is a type of inclusivism, that I'm not saying that you don't bring in this toxic language that you're worshiping a false god or a dead god or you're going to hell or that's a false religion, you have to accept the real religion. This kind of toxic and retarded language really makes it impossible to discuss things. But in civilizations like pagan Europe, for example, or like India for thousands of years, because there is this inclusivism, yes, I respect and accept that you're also worshiping God, that you're also doing something good, but I think that, you know, how about a little upgrade here? So you know, you're still on the same plane, you're going to the same place. It's just like, this may be a little better way you could do that. And so again, in open, inclusive civilizations, it's okay to discuss these things and say that if you know, why don't you consider this additional knowledge, or why don't you consider this enhancement to your spiritual practice? And I think in order to make progress in spirituality and sort of remedy this horrible imbalance between materialism and spiritualism, we have to revive the cultural validity. Because something can be valid, but not for a particular culture. So we have to revive the cultural validity of fair and open discussion, even critical discussion, of, you know, what is God and what is the soul and how do we get there, so that we can start to be objective about these things, again, in an inclusive way, where you respect the other person and acknowledge the presence of God in their life, but you're saying that, you know, you may find this useful. And that's also what Prabhupada brought. And then the last point I wanted to make is for all of you who are history buffs, that I think there's a real sense in which Prabhupada is the culmination of the Renaissance. Because, of course, the French word Renaissance means rebirth. And the word Renaissance was given by the people that did the Renaissance. They're the ones that... It's not a word that historians gave to it later. People like Petrarco, actually, in Italy, and Dante, and so on. And the reason they... And this is very interesting. The reason they called it the Renaissance, because what was it a rebirth of? What was being born again? Interestingly, what was being born again was Vedic culture. Because again, if you look at ancient, let's say, Mediterranean civilization, you know, in Greece and Rome, it's just totally Mediterranean Hinduism. I mean, you can study it and see for yourself. And so, at a certain point, you know, people in the Middle Ages, when they're sort of the high Middle Ages and coming out of the Middle, at a certain point, really intelligent people start to say to themselves, oh my God, we are stuck in this Monty Python movie, basically. You know, the Holy Grail. And so the term Dark Ages, they're the ones that created that term. Like back in the 1300s, I mean, they're the ones that said, wow, these are the Dark Ages. And they began to realize that, you know, there used to be this really fantastic civilization right here where we live. In Italy, in France, you know, and that we used to have this amazing civilization. People were consummate artists like the Greeks. They did sculptures that, you know, were still trying to get back to their skills level. And they wrote incredible books. They were philosophers. They were theologians. That there was this incredible civilization, and now we're just kind of like, ew. You know, we're stuck in this Monty Python movie. So it's like, you know, it's the Dark Ages. So, but the civilization, the great civilization they wanted to revive, and that's why they called it the Renaissance, was really Vedic civilization. I mean, I won't go into all the Indo-European stuff and the linguistic evidence and all that, but so Prabhupada, in coming and bringing Krishna consciousness, bringing this original, powerful Vedic civilization, is really completing the Renaissance. It's sort of the full revival of this great, inclusive, enlightened civilization that was lost. So, anyway, Prabhupada brought so many gifts, and today is the anniversary of the day he left this world. And I'm really glad you all came. I'm glad I came. I heard there was free food, and I couldn't resist. So, anyway, thank you all very much. I really appreciate your coming. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Any questions? Please feel free to agree with me. Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment because I like the idea you introduced about kind of a cultural post-trauma response. And I actually did my thesis on post-traumatic stress in children.
Ooh.
So when children are traumatized young, one of the main results is their sense of self is not developed. And they don't have a strong sense of self. And so you were talking about ahankar, all this artificial identification of what is self. And I'm thinking that that's the post-traumatic response also is that, because that's what you see in children, they don't have a sense of themselves, of who they are. And we, as a culture, don't have a sense of who we are, so all this identification with the body and the clothes and the car and all of that is that post-trauma response also, because
that's a great
we don't
point.
Know who we are, and Prabhupada came to say, who are we? We're the soul, but that's culturally bought, that idea. You know?
That's a great point. So if you really want to be somebody, it's not about getting new clothes and new car. It's about, you know, about finding your real self, your as this magnificent, eternal person that you really are. Yeah, that's a really good point. Anything else? Well, good. Anyway, thank you all so much again, and Hare Krishna. And we'd like to thank Sarabh and Divyananda. Yeah.